part by a grant from The Great Impasta, a restaurant serving foods from northern Italy. The Great Impasta is at 114 West Church in Champaign. The staff at The Great Impasta encourage you to join them in supporting WILL AM 580. Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Lincoln Square Mall in Urbana, with more than a dozen shops, businesses, and restaurants, including International Galleries, Weber and Thies Law Offices, and ABC Billiards, an authorized Brunswick dealer specializing in pool tables, custom cues, and game room furniture.
Good morning. This is Focus 580, our morning telephone talk show. My name is Jack Brighton. Glad you could listen today. In 1983, a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist named Ben Bagdikian wrote a book entitled The Media Monopoly, in which he explored the rapid consolidation of media ownership. At the time, just 21 years ago, 50 companies controlled most of the major media. The book was a wake-up call on an issue few had actually noticed. Unfortunately, we must have hit the snooze button, because today the major media, which includes television, radio, movie studios, record companies, newspapers, magazines, cable and satellite networks, to name a short list, is owned by only 5 giant media corporations. During this hour of Focus 580, we'll talk with Ben Bagdikian about his latest book entitled The New Media Monopoly, a completely revised and updated edition with 7 new chapters, published like the first edition was by the Beacon Press. In this book, Ben Bagdikian updates the picture of the rapid consolidation of media ownership and explores the impact this has had on our politics and culture. We'll talk about that during this hour. A bit more about our guest, Ben Bagdikian. He began his career as a newspaper reporter at the Springfield Morning Union in Massachusetts, then joined the Providence Journal as reporter, foreign correspondent, and eventually Washington bureau chief. In 1970, he became the assistant managing editor for national news at the Washington Post, where he was central to breaking the story of the Pentagon Papers. In 1976, he joined the faculty of the Graduate School of Journalism at the University of California at Berkeley, where in 1985 he became dean. His books include In the Midst of Plenty, The Poor in America, The Information Machines, Caged, 8 Prisoners and Their Keepers, and the aforementioned The Media Monopoly, and a book we spoke with him about about 5 years ago, Double Vision, Reflections on My Heritage, Life, and Profession, also published by Beacon Press. Among Ben Bagdikian's awards are the George Foster Peabody Award and the Pulitzer Prize, and he continues to write on media issues and politics. And we're glad to have him with us this morning. If you would like to join our conversation, all you have to do is pick up the telephone. We welcome your participation in this conversation. The number around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line if you're listening anywhere around the Midwest, or if you're listening on the Internet anywhere in the continental U.S. That number is 800-222-9455. Again, locally, 333-WILL. Toll-free elsewhere, 800-222-WILL. And Ben Bagdikian joins us this morning by telephone. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be on.
Well, I'm glad to talk with you again. I'd like to start with an observation that you make at the beginning of the book about how we all really live in two worlds, the world of flesh and blood in front of our faces and the world we access through media. It's not something we think about much, is it?
Well, yes, I think it's so common. Radio, television, movies, all of the electronic media, that we just take it for granted as a part of our life. But in fact, it is two lives we lead. One is, of course, the life for thousands of years of family, friends, playmates, and human interaction. And we've learned how to deal with that. We know when someone is angry. We know when someone is hostile. We know when someone is friendly. And we learn how to deal with that. Everyone grows up with that, learning that knowledge and inheriting some of that knowledge. The media, in terms of civilization, is relatively new. And especially modern media, which just burst upon us until now, there are times in which it's very hard to distinguish between the artificial media, which is controlled usually commercially, overwhelmingly commercially, and for obviously a profit and advertising, and some public broadcasting, which is an outside source of that, but still, unfortunately, has a minority of listeners. So we are dependent upon the artificial media, which are contrived by business people, and naturally, because every business has to stay alive and make a profit. But this is not an ordinary business. It's not shoelacings. It's not nuts and bolts. It's the kind of product which is a model for children growing up. They see it in the movies. They see it on television, which is a kind of model for the whole population. They see things happening. They create fashions. And when you get every medium, which is under the control of one company, for newspapers, magazines, radio, television, books, movies, you have a complete world run by one company and has enormous power, both in shaping values, national values, and in political power. When the 94 Congress convened, the so-called Gingrich Congress, they called in executives of corporations and said, "What do you want?" And they told them, and they gave it to them. And what that 1996 Act did do is stop specifying the categories of public service which local stations are supposed to give. The result has been that these local stations are now parts of enormous chains with information broadcast coming from thousands of miles away, very little to do with the local community, and frequently canned. I was angry and surprised to learn that the biggest radio chain in the country is Clear Channel. They have 1,200 stations. They have only 200 employees because, of course, they are canned. They're automated. The only thing that interrupts the canned music is Rush Limbaugh and Don Imus. It's become so that American radio has become a right-wing propaganda machine. When you add to that Fox television and radio, which is explicitly right-wing, and the other stations which are not going to criticize corporations, except rarely, as in 60 Minutes, you get then a very powerful social and also political force. It affects legislation. It affects the country's politics. During this period, the country's politics have shifted to the far right, so that what used to be considered the extreme right is now at the center. And what used to be considered liberal is way hanging on the edge by its fingernails, and what was then left, or liberal, has fallen off the edge. Well, it does not reflect what American people say their political values are. The best research, the Pew Research and so forth, shows that most Americans are moderate in their politics. They are either center-right-leaning or center-left-leaning. Center-right-leaning is slightly more than center-left, but they are not radically divided. Mm-hmm. Our broadcasting, however, is totally out of sync with that, so that we are not seeing a reflection of our lives in our own broadcasting system, which, incidentally, it seemed to be lost, that the American public owns the airwaves, not the broadcasters. We aren't getting what represents a vastly different ethnicity, region. We get homogenized information that is designed to be as inexpensive as possible and as powerfully controlled at a central point.
I'm sorry, I was going to ask
you. No, go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to ask you to talk a little bit more about this issue, because there seems to be some debate. Some people, you know, say that the media don't drive our politics, but simply reflect our politics. And you argue that, in fact, over the past 50 years, the media have very much driven us in a very conservative direction politically that, as you just stated, doesn't reflect the mood of the country. I want to ask you to amplify on how that has happened.
Well, it's happened because we have gone through a 20-year surge of deregulation. The initial argument for deregulating all kinds of things, everything from the Federal Communications Commission to the Securities and Exchange Commission, is that corporations said, well, now, regulations are simply creating a lot of red tape. They hold back business. They hamper companies from serving their customers and so forth. So we deregulated. And for example, in the case of SEC, where do you suppose the Enrons and the Tycos and the most respected banks in the country playing very funny accounting games at the expense of their depositors and stockholders because these regulations were designed to prevent that? And in broadcasting, the chairman of the present Federal Communications Commission, Mr. Powell, says he thinks there are so many channels now that there is no need for broadcast regulations. Well, it's true, there are many more channels than ever before. The problem is they all, almost all owned by the same companies, the same big five or six companies. And so that what gets on is decided by a number of people. I put in my book, I was trying to describe how you could illustrate how few people control what the American people know or don't know, see and don't see, from news to movies to recordings and everything else. The executives of those five companies could fit into a phone booth. And that's much too great a power to be held by so few people.
Well, let's talk about who those five people in that phone booth are. You name them, and there are five companies that are at the top. Most of them three of them are American companies, and two are not. Can you talk about who they are?
You know, the biggest in the world is Time Warner, biggest in number of companies and their reach. And I'm talking about every medium. The next news corporation, Rupert Murdoch, who is explicitly right-wing, has all right-wing commentators, and is very powerful and uses his broadcasting power to get what he wants out of Congress. For 50 years, he was permitted to break the law, the broadcasting law, which said that the basic corporation of any broadcasting station and system has to be based in the United States. And for 50 years, while he was building his power, he kept his station, his company, News Corporation, based in Australia, where the taxes were low. And only in the last couple of years has he moved its base to the United States. So this, another big one is Murdoch. Disney is yet another one of the big five. And Disney, of course, is dominant in every medium and is a good example of what they all do. They use one of their media to promote others of their media, but I'll explain that in a moment.
Sure.
Another big one is Bertelsmann, which is a German corporation, but which is about the fourth largest media company in the United States. They have 82 big book houses, Random, Knopf, and so forth. They control magazines like Family Weekly and Parents. A big record company, RCA, RCA Victor, Wyndham Hill. And then you have on very close to those General Electric, which, of course, controls NBC and all that flows out of that. And so there's five with a close sixth in General Electric. Mm-hmm. And Viacom, I didn't mention, which is the former CBS. Mm-hmm. So those companies have all the media, and what they look for, since they have all media, powerful in all the media, they look for recyclable material. Let me describe that. Mm-hmm. If they own a big magazine chain, they will have a magazine story. That will be made into a book. The book will be promoted on their radio talk shows. That will then become a movie. The movie, which studio they own, the stars of the movie will be interviewed in the talk shows. They'll be promoted in the other media. And so that each hand washes the other. They use it as a mutual aid society among all of their different media. And it becomes very hard for an independent voice to be heard in this closed circle. And that is one of the major problems. It also means that when they go to Washington, they are so powerful, politicians are loath to offend them. When they want something, they usually get it. If we try to put public service duties on them, and it must be remembered that we, the American people, own the airwaves where they make their money, and they are supposed to serve the public interest. Now, the communications law, wisely, doesn't mandate what their programs must do, and I think that's proper. But what it does say, they should serve the public interest and should have respect for news and public permission, access to their stations by local people. It doesn't say what the news has to do, so the news can be right-wing and the government is properly can't stop that. What they did used to have until the mid-'80s was something called the Fairness Doctrine. Mm-hmm. And all that said was, if in exercising their broadcasting, a company, broadcasting company, seriously criticizes an individual or an organization, that individual or organization will have the right of reply. The broadcasters, the National Association of Broadcasters, went to Congress, said, look, we want civic discussions. We want each city that we're in to have people come in and argue pro and con of what the public issues are in that city. And but this fairness doctrine is really so onerous, which means we daily speak about any of these issues because we spend all our time answering, having people answer. Just repeal that, and we'll increase our civic discussions. So the government repealed it, and in the next 6 months, civic discussions dropped 30%, and they've been dropping ever since.
Yeah.
You very seldom, on a big market, hear any debate about big local issues. So what we have with these companies is political power as well as social broadcast power.
Mm-hmm. I want to ask you to talk a little bit more about the corporations that own the media and how their ownership affects what gets covered in the news. Companies that own the media, of course, they own much more than just the media. So their self-interest extend into many areas the media should be thoroughly covering. But as we saw in the Enron, the case of Enron and Global Crossing and Tyco and some of the others, the story that maybe should have been told 2, 3, 4, 5, however many years before that, suddenly became a surprise that all this stuff was happening.
Well, in broadcasting, let's just take one. General Electric, which is a close sixth to the Big Five, it owns NBC. General Electric produces nuclear reactors. It produces electric generating stations. It is a major weapons supplier for the Department of Defense. You are not apt to hear a vigorous debate on the pros and cons of nuclear power, of fairness, of Pentagon contracts to corporations. because these companies are in that business as well, in the case of General Electric, nor with the others, which are not in big manufacturing districts, the Time Warners and Viacoms and News Corporation. You will not find on their programs criticism or discussion of the dangers of concentrated power over news, what people will hear and not hear on their news programs. So we are really in the hands of a very small group which even decides what news we'll hear. Now, there are news sources, thank goodness, outside that, but they are minority ones. Most people, according to all the best surveys, depend on network news and local news for finding out what's going on in their communities and in the country. Local television news in the United States is a kind of national joke or disgrace in most places. There are exceptions, but mostly it's the latest murder in the community, the latest bloody accident, and then happy talk, and then mostly weather and sports. You don't hear very serious local news. The idea is to have it all fun, all entertainment. They've even created what for someone who grew up in journalism is repelled by, the term infotainment, that is, handling news as entertainment. Well, news is not entertainment. It is sometimes amusing. Sometimes it is entertaining when events occur which have a basic humor about them. But for the most part, people want to hear serious things about the problems that affect them personally. And you don't hear much of that. You don't hear information and discussions about what the average family has to deal with. You'd hear the problems of the very rich, and the sponsors want either the young who are going to buy sneakers, tennis shoes, and so forth, or 18 to 35 family formation years when they buy furniture and things of that sort. And they fashion their programs around that. So the journalistic selection of news, which is of most important as a priority and then going on from there, along with human interest stories, and on the local level, is unfortunately a kind of national joke or disgrace, the way, depending on how high your journalistic standards are. Network news, except for Rupert Murdoch's News Corporation, the Fox Network, is generally much more disciplined, CBS, NBC, and ABC. They come out of a past period when news was considered sacred. You had a professional staff. They picked what was the most important things, and there's a great deal of momentum to that. So they are not like the local news, which goes only for blood and guts. But local news is a serious problem. And it's an especially difficult problem, a troublesome problem, in the United States, because unlike any other industrial democracy, we leave central functions to each community, which in other countries are national bureaucracies. For example, each community controls its own schools. In almost every other industrial country, that's a national bureaucracy. England, France, Germany, Italy, and so forth. So people need to know news about their school boards and their curricula that their kids are going to be subject to. But they don't get a whole lot of that. Very few local stations in the major markets cover meetings of the school board, even when there's something very contentious to be decided. We control our own policing. We control most of our taxes locally. We control land use locally. those are not the subjects that we learn about. What happens is most of the citizens are confronted with a fait accompli. These things are decided by a small group of people without warning and without having a public procedure. So that there are exceptions to that when there are community, when it gets out and the community wants a hearing. But for the majority, a small bureaucracy does it without coverage by the news, because the news wants spectacle. And every TV, almost every TV studio, the reporters are told, we want emotion, we want drama. And the reason they want that is a dubious invention, I think, in American television watching, the remote control. When the average viewer of television turns on the set, whatever happens to come on the screen may fix his attention, and the people who produce programs know that. So they want a high probability of the first time the television set gets on, something tension-building, dramatic, strikes them, so they won't go surfing.
Yeah.
And because everybody fears the mute button, the channel button, and, God save us, the off button.
Right.
And so that changed the dynamics of broadcasting, where you had to fix the viewer right away. So you get a series of very dramatic things, one right after the other. This does not make for quiet, intelligent discussion of local issues.
We're about our midpoint. I'm sorry to interrupt, but I wanted to make sure to reintroduce our guest for those who may have joined us since the introduction. We're talking with Ben Bagdikian. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist of many years, former dean of the Graduate School of Journalism at University of California, Berkeley, and he's author of a number of books, among them the latest, The New Media Monopoly, a complete revised and updated edition with 7 new chapters, published by the Beacon Press. We have a couple callers to talk with, so I'd like to include them in our conversation. Why don't we do that? And we have someone first in Chicago on line number 4. Good morning.
Yes, I have a couple questions. First of all, you know, in light of control of the media with large corporations, how do you account for the liberal bias that you find on most of the networks and newspapers? You would think it would just be the opposite. There'd be a conservative bias, but it seems that it seems all one-sided. Like even with the news of from Iraq, if you watch the TV news, you can't miss it. I just wonder, how do you account for that? That's going on with all this corporate control.
As long as I've been a journalist, which is more years than I'd like to count, the conservatives have said that there is liberal bias in the news. I've been a journalist. And I can tell you that the threshold for getting liberal ideas into the newspapers, on the air, on television, in commercial broadcasting, has a higher threshold than news which is conservative. Where do most of our news come from? They come from people with titles, people who are CEOs of companies, who are the heads of big organizations, the chairs of legislative committees. They come from the high authorities. How often do you hear quoted in equal ways a labor union leader, a consumers group, even a national prominent consumers group? How often do you hear that? Almost never. So that the idea of a liberal bias is, I think, a fixation among conservatives who believe that theirs is the only truth, that theirs is ordained to be the correct thing for the country. Now, that's not unusual for a political group, but they happen to be consistent with the feelings of most of the powerful corporate owners. There are very few socialists and liberals and people who run large corporations. Large corporations want lowest possible taxes or no taxes at all. They want minimal government regulation. They don't want consumer groups testing their products and announcing it. They're very conservative. So, of course, the conservatives say any time, say in public radio or any, that does not reflect the corporate point of view is a liberal bias.
Well, I think you must be watching different media than I watch then, because you can't even miss it on the entertainment programs. You see it put into themes. You know, half of these sitcoms and movies are really morality plays, in my opinion, liberal morality plays. So you must just be watching a different kind of media than I'm watching.
Well, I wonder if you're also talking, like you said, the entertainment channels as opposed to the news coverage and the kinds of coverage that people learn about the world from. Do you think, I'm asking the caller, is, you know, when it comes to news, do you see?
I see it permeate the whole broadcasting. The only exception would be, you know, in talk radio, it's almost like a refuge for conservatives. I think talk radio is kind of the other way, but I think it doesn't have the general impact as network media do and the newspapers. So, but I do think that in the talk radio, you might say, well, that is kind of towards the conservative end. But I'd say that in the general media, the one with the general coverage like the TVs, even local TVs, I just can't miss the liberal bias, and it even goes into the moral issues, and you see it on the programs. Just like, you know, MTV and those types of things in a network programming, you just can't miss it, liberal politically and news-wise and liberal moral-wise. It just, you know, I can't miss it.
Well, I think that's true in some of the new media that have emerged. MTV, for example, began as a kind of protest medium, and it comes out occasionally with very popular entertainers who are obviously liberal in their views. And I think some of that is true, but it has to come out in this indirect way. It has to come out in Doomsbury, in the comic strips, mm-hmm. and that kind of thing, in which criticism of power becomes a side voice that comes from the wings. It is not on the main stage, but it's there. And I think the Internet has had an influence on expanding the number of political voices. And so I agree. I think that there are now outlets that do that, but they do not match the power of the other side on the standard wide spectrum of commercial broadcasting that is seen by most people. If you look at the audiences, you will see that most people really depend on the standard big broadcasts. But if you want to find opposite views, you can. Mm-hmm. Printed and broadcast. But they are, you have to look for them much more carefully, while the others are the standard broadcasts. So I agree with you. There are voices now, and I think they're increasing.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think they have an impact because people are excited by hearing them.
Yeah. One of the shows that I hear people talking a lot about is The Daily Show with Jon Stewart. Have you seen that?
Yeah,
some people think that's one of the best news shows actually on television these days. It's a pretty amusing show. I do want to get on to other callers. We have several people waiting, so if it's okay with you, let's talk with some other listeners. Next up, someone in Urbana, line number one. Good morning.
Yes, good morning. I don't, of course, know what is in the mind of your previous caller, but if he would see a liberal bias in the news to reflect what they are saying about the bad economy and the way the war is being misconducted in Iraq, I supposedly he would think that, yes, that is a liberal bias. On the other hand, I listen to and here on public radio and the BBC, and I hear that the war is being disastrously conducted in Iraq, and I assume that on the network news it's even more so. although I must say I really disagree with the previous caller. I think that he just can't bear to see anybody criticizing Bush, and so he has bought, I think, the very cynical view of the corporate communications that there is a liberal bias. I really don't think that the people in the large corporate, the corporate communication series believe there is a liberal bias. I think they just use that phrase because it's so handy and so catchy. I think they know exactly what they're doing. They're putting out news that reflects their own interests. I was sorry to see locally that we had a free paper that was distributed, which, of course, depends on advertisement. And it talked about what was going on, you know, in terms of entertainment and restaurants, et cetera. But it also had a very lively political list of contributing columnists. And they were fascinating, and they were interesting, and they did have a liberal bias, and I thought that was kind of good, since you can't get a liberal bias in this town with our local newspaper. And it folded. I don't know why, whether it was financial or whatever. And I happened to talk to the people who brought out something new. I won't even mention what the name of the new free weekly newspaper is. But I called and said, you know, I read your first issue, and I thought it was kind of blah. You know, I really miss the commentary, the political commentary, the letters to the editor that was carried by the previous newspaper. And the lady who answered the phone, and I do not know her name, said honestly to me, well, that was their problem. They had too much politics, and advertisers just don't want to advertise when you have political commentary. And I thought, very interesting. Thank you, you know, ma'am, for that honest report. And so I know that the only liberal paper in this town is the Public Eye, which is put out by the Independent Media Center here in town. But I don't think there is much independent media, except maybe in little conclaves like Champaign-Urbana that has kind of an intellectual leaning, I would say. And it's certainly not an intellectual community, but a certain intellectual leaning. So, and I do regret even McNeil Lair. I feel that all they do is report what the officials in the administration are saying. I don't even hear anything of a contradictory nature. And even if they have something that's a little bit critical of the current Republican administration, then that person, then they come out and say, so-and-so does not speak for public radio, you know, as if somehow public radio would be contaminated by a liberal thought. Well, thank you for letting me go on. I do agree with this author that it is a very sad state that corporate communications, and it's not just corporate communications, it's conservative corporate communications. So thank you for letting me air my opinions.
Okay.
I will hang up.
All right, thanks. Well, Mr. Bagdikian, there's a lot that the caller said that you should feel free to comment upon, but I wanted to sort of ask you to talk in particular about the coverage of the war in Iraq. And the coverage that we get in the United States, you know, I'm pretty aware of the international coverage. It's almost like there's two different wars going on. The coverage in the U.S. is so different from the way it is being reported elsewhere around the world.
Yes, that's true. But before I think that's important. But let me say one
sure.
thing about the previous callers. I think if you change the term liberal bias to a liberal point of view, you begin to see that anything that is not conservative is considered a bias, whereas it's simply a different point of view. And I think that's an important point in the use of language. On the Iraq War, I think that The news on the whole has, in the beginning, had failed the American public. In the fall of 2002, as the elections were approaching, what were the headlines on the papers? Growing unemployment, growing indebtedness among middle-class people, big tax cuts for the rich, but more desperation at the lower-income level. Those were the headlines. More companies found corrupt, more companies laying off by the 10,000s, the 100,000s. And then on October 21, the president announced that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction and represented an imminent threat to the United States. That was the end of those headlines about domestic problems. That was the end of the probability that the Democrats would take the Senate, because they were only one vote short. And that became then a war, we became a war economy and a war news establishment. It was a totally artificial move. We had, Iraq did used to have weapons of mass destruction, which we sold him in 1980 so he could fight the Iranians, and they were all used. And we knew that. Senator Byrd did a very, on the Senate floor, did an inventory of all of that. But, of course, the networks treated it, the commercial networks, as this aging orator having his pitiful turn on the floor and didn't give the details of what he said. So that the American people suddenly were shocked to believe that Iraq represented Al-Qaeda, which, of course, was hated. Iraq was hated by Al-Qaeda. It was a secular state. That they had weapons of mass destruction. They did not have them. And we turned Iraq into rubble with horrific bombing. We are very good at precision at heavy bombing. But shockingly, we had no plan for what happens after we invade and everything is rubble. So that it was late when the major media examined what the whole Iraq war suddenly meant in terms of domestic politics and in world politics. We now have more of the Muslim world that hates us than ever before. We have done exactly the wrong things. We have lied about it. I mean, they lied at the highest levels of the government. We went against what we knew to be true, at least in which our intelligence agencies knew to be true. The Pentagon dismissed the regular agents, intelligence agencies, and formed their own intelligence, which turned out to be immensely flawed. Although these were intellectuals of high training, they totally misled themselves and the American people, and we now have a mess that is not going to be solved very easily. If we leave in June 30, there will be civil war. There's already a small civil war going on. It'll become a much greater one. The Kurds are very suspicious of the Shiite majority. The Shiites are split. We are finding it necessary to reappoint Saddam Hussein's leaders in order to bring order. It is an ironic picture of a massive governmental error and cynicism. And only lately have most of the media begun to catch up with how disastrous this has been. The New York Times, I must say, began earlier than most, but we are now confronted with a disaster, and we were not prepared ahead of time to recognize those people who were naysayers, because in general, as I said before, we take the word of the highest authorities as the basis of our news. And as we know, the authorities are not always right, and when you hold up most of the power, your errors tend to go uncorrected, and I think that's what happened in Iraq.
Okay. We have several callers, and maybe just about 6 minutes left. We'll try to get in as many as we can. We'll go next to a listener in, where are we going next? let's see, listener on line number two, I believe, in Urbana. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
It seems that the last few callers have basically agreed with your idea that the majority of people get the majority of their information from tightly held, I suppose, sources, and still want to debate with you other sources, because we may have an unusual situation in our small community. So, keeping on that theme, I wondered whether you had a sense of how many people are being reached, those who want to go searching for alternate sources of information, what fraction, proportion, by such outlets as the self-described independent media outlets, individual reports on the nearly chaotic internet. What sort of fraction of people are actually looking for alternatives and being served by alternatives? I'll hang up and listen to your discussion.
Okay, thank you.
Well, I think that there are, from the beginning, there were, of course, some voices on the internet. Move On, for example, turned hundreds of thousands of people out marching against the war. And that was strictly by internet. But I think that increasingly there is despair among a widening number of ordinary Americans that this is not only costly, it's killing Americans, it's killing more Iraqis, and we have no prospect of a democracy in Iraq, which has not had one for a very long time, and that we're stuck. We say we're going to get out, but we can't get out if there's a civil war going on. And where we initially insulted the United Nations, said they were irrelevant, we now are saying they must go in, but the United Nations doesn't have the resources because the member nations have to give it a lot of money, have to donate a lot of troops, and much more powerfully than they have available now. So I think that the United States, in the eyes of much of the world, is seen either as a hostile force or as an incompetent force. And that's for an American, for me, it's terribly sad. I was in the military service during World War II. There was certitude. There was no question about the need for it. We were attacked. This is very, very different and very, very sad.
We have another caller waiting on line number four in Chicago. Let's speak with them. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Hello. I'm not sure if you covered this before because I came in late, but I'm really distressed about the liberal media's attack on Ralph Nader. I could not understand for the life of me why they were against him running. There was data that showed that he did not take votes away from Al Gore, that he took votes away from George Bush. There was also data that showed many other reasons why Gore lost. But despite that argument, the simple fact that in America we need more parties rather than less, and it's just focusing everything on getting rid of Bush, and they've ignored how our Congress has betrayed us. And they've ignored the fact that 45% of the voting public are voting in elections. And, I mean, it seems like there were other issues that they could have campaigned on, the fact that we need more voter registration, the fact that we need to reform Congress. But to be against Ralph Nader running, I felt shocked and betrayed, and I began to think, what is the problem with these people? I don't understand that.
Well, I think that most of the objection to Ralph Nader running that I hear is the fear that this will guarantee a Bush electoral success, because in the 2000 elections that seemed to be the case, that in Florida and New Mexico and a number of other places, Nader was very popular, and his vote may have made the difference. So that I think that there is such a fear among people who are not already committed to Mr. Bush that he will succeed if there are votes that are drained off from the anti-Bush vote. And I think that explains why there is so many questions have been raised about Ralph Nader running again, because he could be the a margin of difference. That may or may not be true. I think he is an independent voice. I think he is one of the greater benefactors for good government and good consumption, good consumer control in the United States. But I think that it becomes controversial because of the fear that he may represent the margin which will permit Bush to be reelected among people who don't want him reelected.
I'm sorry to say that we are out of time, and there is much more that we could discuss if we had more. I will suggest to folks, if you'd like to read more on the topic, the book is The New Media Monopoly, a completely revised and updated edition with 7 new chapters. It's now available in paperback from the Beacon Press, and this is a book that was originally published in 1983. It's been through, this is the 7th edition, is that correct?
It's the 7th and almost totally new.
That's right, and there's a lot of good stuff in there, so if you'd like to read more, then you should take a look. The author has been our guest, Ben Bagdikian. His last name is spelled B-A-G-D-I-K-I-A-N. And to you, Mr. Bagdikian, thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, thank you. It's an enjoyable program.
That's it for this hour of Focus 580. It's time to hand things off to today's host of the Afternoon Magazine, our news director, Tom Rogers. Tom?
Good afternoon, Jack, and I'm in for Celeste Quinn today on the Afternoon Magazine. Coming up in the 1 o'clock hour, after our noontime look at news from NPR and the BBC and AM 580, we are going to have an interview from the archives. Celeste Quinn conducted this interview a little while back in March with Lori Lynn Drummond. She's an author of a book entitled Anything You Say Can and Will Be Used Against You. She was a police officer for 8 years, and her first book is a collection of short stories about the lives of 5 female police officers who are working in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. We'll have that coming up in the 1 o'clock hour. Also, one of the last of our looks at the life of Alistair Cook and one of his letters from America, some of the best that